Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX-AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be heard live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest this afternoon is Michael A. Cohn, speechwriter, commentator about foreign policy and American contemporary political issues. Our subject today is the Middle East, life after the deposed dictators, and 1 year after he last visited, and we discussed politics, the Tea Party, and governing through stalemate. The state of American politics as we enter into the coming last 2 months of the year, the holidays, and the next stage, the American political season, with caucuses, primaries, and starting earlier and earlier. As I say each week, the mission of the advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy is therefore what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Michael, welcome back to the advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. You know, Michael Cohn is a senior fellow at the American Security Project and is author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. He's also been a senior fellow at the New American Foundation and the World Policy Institute. His research has focused on the growing role and influence of non-state actors. He has written on the issue of private military contractors, reforming the foreign assistance bureaucracy, improving aid and coordination between public and private sector. He is a regular blogger at democracyarsenal.org. He serves on the board of the National Security Network and taught at Columbia University School of International Public Affairs. He's previously served in the U.S. State Department as a chief speechwriter for Bill Richardson at the United Nations and Undersecretary of State Stuart Eisenstadt. He's worked for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Foreign Policy magazine and also as a speechwriter for Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut. He's been a frequent commentator on politics and international affairs. His work has been published in the Wall Street Journal, The Times, New York Times, of course, The Washington Post, Christian Science Monitor, and many other sites. He's also been featured on ABC News, Good Morning America Now, Fox News, BBC TV, Al Jazeera Air America, The Brian Lehrer Show, and many other programs, which include, of course, his four previous visits to the Advocates, going back to his pre-presidential show in late October of 2008. With regards to our subject, the Middle East, North Africa, and the Arabian Peninsula have been big news all over the spring and summer. Uprisings in Yemen, Syria, Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya have successfully removed three longtime dictators and have threatened the regimes in other totalitarian Arab states. In and amongst the clamor of these tectonic shifts, which have eliminated decades-old political dynasties, the issue of Palestinian statehood has reached the floor of the UN General Assembly. The issue, of course, is the long-term conflict between the Israelis, the Arab peoples of the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, who call themselves Palestinians. In May of this year, you wrote, "It is certainly appropriate for members of Congress to disagree with the president's foreign policy agenda, but it's something else altogether to be appearing to work in concert with a leader of another country and trying to put the president on the defensive and seeking to score partisan political advantage in the process. By openly siding with Netanyahu against Obama and making Arab-Israeli peace a partisan issue, Republicans in Congress are at serious risk of crossing a dangerous line in the process of undermining U.S. interests in the Middle East." Michael, what did you mean by that, and how do you see Prime Minister Netanyahu and his party as an impediment to moving forward with the peace process?
Well, we're talking about, I think, two different issues here. I mean, first of all, that particular piece was written a couple months ago, but it was referring to the invitation of Congress to Prime Minister Netanyahu to speak at to a joint session of Congress as a way to rebut the president's Middle East speech, and this was, again, a few months ago. But what's happened more recently is, I think, more troubling, which is you've seen that because of the vote in the UNESCO, which is the UN Economic and Social Council, that there's the U.S., because they've given basically Palestinians a seat in the organization. And because of that, under U.S. law, the U.S. must now leave UNESCO or must stop contributing to UNESCO. This effort will continue across a number of UN agencies where you will see the U.S. leave these agencies or stop contributing because of the Palestinian effort to gain recognition. And this is going to hurt, you know, U.S. foreign policy interests. And yet, if you look at what the reaction of Congress has been, it's a little concerned about this. And in fact, they've shown no indication, either Republicans or Democrats, to reverse this step and to actually provide a waiver to the president. So I think what you're seeing is a Congress that is seemingly putting its own views of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict ahead of the president, and in a sense putting Israel's views and Israel's own proclivities ahead of that of what's best for U.S. national interest. Nobody, I think, would believe that it's in the U.S. national interest to not be a member of these U.N. organizations. Maybe Rick Perry believes that, but I think most Americans don't believe that. And yet, out of loyalty to Israel, this is the road we're about to go down. So I think it's very indicative of what the debate along Israel has developed over the past couple of months and even years, obviously, that you have Congress that seems more interested in putting Israel's interests ahead of those of America's, frankly.
Well, you did mention the UNESCO situation, and the United States has withdrawn $60 million in funding from it. And also, this seems to dovetail in sort of a reverse way to, as you mentioned, Rick Perry and other Republicans who'd like to even defund the UN, would like to even have us withdraw from that. Is that a nihilistic position that's unsustainable with the American people?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I was working for the U.S. ambassador to the UN 15 years ago, and this issue came up then as well. There were efforts to defund the UN, and certainly at that time, UN dues were not being paid by the United States. I mean, I don't consider it a serious proposal. I don't think it's one that would actually happen. And the thing is, what's so sort of crazy about it is that it would really hurt U.S. foreign policy interests. I mean, we actually get a great deal from being in the UN. We have a great deal of influence within the UN as a permanent member of the Security Council and having a veto in the Security Council. So I don't understand how it actually further U.S. interests in any way, shape, or form to not be a member of the United Nations. The evidence is sort of overwhelming that it, in fact, furthers our interests.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, you have to have organizations where you can talk, where you can have international policing forces. The United States is an influential member of it, and you can't have everything you want your way. You know, you also wrote House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, after meeting with Netanyahu, suggested that a Republican Congress would serve as a check on the Obama administration when it came to Israeli policy, a position he later sought to, walk away from. If in the fall of 2009, Cantor criticized the Obama administration for its rebuke of the Israeli government over the eviction of Palestinian families in East Jerusalem's Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Most surprising of all, the attack was lodged from Jerusalem, where Cantor was heading a 25-person GOP delegation. An unusual violation of the unspoken rule that members of Congress should refrain from criticizing the U.S. government while on foreign soil. Michael, is this a pattern which has developed with a new right faction of the GOP? And did Texas Governor Rick Perry get out of line when he came to New York City when President Obama spoke of the UN and said Obama's appeasement towards the Palestinians had put Israel in a position of weakness and emboldened Palestinian leaders? Is that true?
No. In fact, it's really, the last few years of American politics, I really feel like you've kind of encountered these sort of Alice in Wonderland sort of arguments that are totally divorced from reality. The notion that Obama has thrown Israel under the bus, and you can criticize, you can quibble with his policies on Israel. He's been too strong, he hasn't been strong enough. But the notion that he threw them under the bus, and at the same time that the U.S. was furiously lobbying in the U.N. to prevent recognition of the Palestinians by the General Assembly, and the fact that the U.S. was sort of willing to veto a resolution that would have create a Palestinian state. The idea that after all those actions, the U.S. is throwing Israel under a bus, I don't know what Obama has to do to get on Israel's good side from the GOP perspective. I don't know what else he could do. Maybe he needs to tape a kick-me sign at the back of Mahmoud Abbas, and that would make the Republicans happy. I don't get it. because there really isn't much more he could do to the support of Israel. In fact, if you look back at this, I mean, what's interesting is that in 09, the administration did put pressure on or try to push Israel to stop settlement growth in and around East Jerusalem, which, by the way, has been, you know, policy of the U.S. government since the Reagan administration to oppose settlement expansion in the territories. After that moratorium expired, the Israelis have continued building settlements, and the U.S. government has really not done much of pressure on them. And again, that policy by the Israelis is in direct violation of U.S. policy. So there isn't really any, I don't see any evidence at all to back up this notion, and you hear this all the time, that somehow, you know, Obama is throwing his own on the bus. If anything, he has been, in my view, too supportive of Israel, particularly as it pursues policies that are not only not in Israel's long-term interest, but certainly not in the U.S. long-term interest.
Now, let's reflect back not only in foreign policy, but domestic policy. Do you see the right wing's new love affair with Israel and conservative Jews in America as sincere or just election year pandering?
Well, I think what's happening is that it's not just that they're pandering to, for example, I mean, they are pandering. Let's get that out of the way. They are pandering. I mean, most, very often, foreign policy, strong-held foreign politicians, you know, like Republican support for Israel is sort of, you know, political pandering, and there is some of that. There's a large constituency in support of Israel in the U.S., and there is support of the Palestinians. This is, you know, pretty straightforward. What's happening, though, in the GOP is sort of fascinating, because it's not just a question of pandering for Jewish votes, which you might traditionally expect. It's actually pandering for evangelical votes, evangelical Christians, who have become, in some ways, more supportive of Israel than actually American Jews. I was in Israel in August, and I actually happened to be there during the Glenn Beck rally, which was sort of a fascinating experience. And I was struck by the fact that a good group of the audience was, in fact, evangelical Christians who had come over with Beck to show support for Israel. And so this has become a big cause celeb on the right wing. So I think what you're seeing is not this. I mean, really, sort of beyond the pale sort of notion of that the U.S. must, you know, consistently support Israel no matter what it does. Is really, I think, not a pander to Jews, but to Christians, and I think it will continue in so long as the support in the evangelical community for Israel continues to exist. But I wouldn't do anything more than just basically playing politics.
Now, getting away from the aspects of lip service, you know, political lip service on the right, political lip service supporting President Obama, all sorts of things, let's quickly talk about what the Israeli fears are of a Palestinian state. Would one say, or one could say, that the greatest fear of a Palestinian state is the fact that it would have open borders to access of weaponry that could change the balance within the, you know, mandate area, the pre-1947 mandate area, which includes modern Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, etc. Is this the greatest fear, that the Palestinians as a nation state could have an air force, could have a large army, etc., that could be a threat to Israel?
I mean, I suppose that is the fear. It's a completely unrealistic fear, and it's one that is really divorced from a larger strategic reality, which is that, you know, first of all, any peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, I'm sure, would restrict the size and of any kind of Palestinian military.
But will they agree to that?
Well, I would imagine they would. I mean, and I imagine it would be part of any agreements. At the very least, I think, you know, there's Israel's ability to control or to affect what Palestinians could do in West Bank as far as building up the military would continue to exist even if Israel wasn't there. I mean, you know, in some ways, the legitimacy for Israel to militarily attack the Palestinian group community would be much greater if it was an independent nation as opposed to being an occupied people.
Sure.
But I don't really see it as a big concern, and I don't see, you know, that, and to me it's an issue that can really be dealt with by Israel. The larger issue is, and the larger strategic concern is not, you know, the sort of, you know, 1% possibility that is that Palestine will become, you know, some great military power. It seems very unlikely. The greater risk is to Israeli democracy, which is that you have Israel controlling, you know, a majority of Palestinians, becoming what would be a de facto apartheid state. That, to me, is a much bigger concern. Moreover, you know, a lot of what causes instability and for Israel and causes animosity towards Israel in the region is the fact that there is no Palestinian state. A surefire way for Israel to deflect some of the hatred that exists in the region is to stop occupying the West Bank and de facto Gaza.
Well, I think Israel would like to personally. Now, it's a possibility that they would not like to. I mean, you have three situations: a greater Israel Palestine, which the Palestinians would love. They'd outvote the Israelis. I think the Palestinian population would be 46% of that population immediately. I don't think anybody in Israel wants that. In reality, the second situation is the way it is today, which is a big problem going forward. And the third is a Palestine, an independent Palestine, possibly with some type of union with Gaza that could be not a threat to Israel. Is that where we would like to go?
Well, yeah. I mean, what we'd like to go is toward a two-state solution, but we're no closer to a two-state solution. We're actually closer to a one-state solution, which would be Israel controlling the West Bank, for the foreseeable future. The fears that Israel has are not baseless. I mean, the fears of Palestinian terrorism exist. The thing is, those the potential of terrorism, the potential of instability, is only going to become more pronounced the longer that there is no path to a resolution of the conflict. If that's the fear of Israel, then the policies they're pursuing are actually having the opposite effect. They're actually making Israel more unsafe. They're isolating Israel more. We see that with the UN vote internationally. That's clearly happening. They're putting them at more risk of a third intifada. They're creating more dissension within the region toward Israel. You're already seeing this from Turkey. You're seeing this toward Egypt. And, of course, some people would like to argue that this is because they don't like Israel and they're anti-Semitic and so forth. But it really is a question of opposing Israeli policies toward the Palestinians.
I tend to agree with you on that. You've been listening to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. My guest today is Michael A. Cohn. We've been talking about his thoughts on the right-wing support for the Netanyahu government in Israel. Now I'd like to hear his thoughts on the future of Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya in the wake of these successful revolutions. Michael, all three of these countries are different, except they're populated by a vast majority of Arab Muslims. What would you say is the general prognosis on what will happen in the wake of these great changes, and how do you see the potentiality of a move to quasi-democratic rule?
I think to answer the first part, I mean, I don't know, which is fine, because these sort of transitions do take a long time to fully materialize, and you're talking about three countries that have no democratic tradition. Although Tunisia just had a free and fair election, 90% turnout. The Islamist parties, I think, did pretty well, but to me, it's a great sign for the potential for a democracy taking root in Tunisia. I mean, yes, in Tunisia, based on these early results. The path is less clear on Egypt and Libya. It looks, frankly, a little more troubling. In Egypt, you certainly have elections coming up in the fall, but a lot of indications that the Egyptian military is holding on to power pretty tightly. So I don't know how that's going to play itself out. And Libya, I think, is just, we're still in the civil war. It's still, the fighting hasn't ended completely. I think it's too soon to tell. I think all three, there is potential for... Even that democracy, there's only stability, or certainly regimes take root that have some sort of popular support. But it's, again, we don't know. And I think it's incumbent upon the U.S. to try to play some kind of role, not a military role, but a political role, and try to move these countries in the right direction. But inevitably, what happens will depend on decisions made within, Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya.
Right. There's been, and of course, there are three different societies, and we have a sense of their differences. There's been a lot of clatter with Fox News, the right wing media, and the current Republican field about foreign aid. The problem of foreign aid, where the bulk of it goes and how it's spent. Tell us about the bulk of foreign aid and how it relates to the Middle East and these questions and their concerns.
Well, I mean, the bulk of U.S. foreign aid actually has been in Israel and Egypt. It's part of the Camp David Accord. And foreign aid is, it's less than 1% of all U.S. It's less than 1% of the U.S. budget. It's a very small percentage. And what's upsetting right now is you're seeing moves in Congress to try to cut foreign aid. And you know, it's sort of a crazy thing to think about. You see these democratic transitions happening in countries all across the region, you know, and at the same time, the U.S. should be actively involved in this. We're seeing people in Congress wanting to cut funding. And at the same time that, you know, you're seeing, you know, people in Congress and in the administration fighting tooth and nail to prevent defense cuts from occurring. So we seem to have this, you know, this sort of pattern of putting more money into our military and not enough money into foreign aid and not enough money into diplomacy. It seems like right now that the latter is more important than the former.
Now, is this a fool's journey that the Republican leading voices are discussing? Is this a throwback to isolationism? You want to withdraw from the UN, you want to defund international organizations, you want to cut back on foreign aid. I mean, how can you have it both ways? How can you have influence with around the world and not have some sort of financial involvement and connection between these bodies? Isn't this paradoxical?
Yes, I would think it is paradoxical. I don't think it's a sign of isolationism. I mean, I don't see any indication of that beyond, you know, sort of Ron Paul, I suppose. I mean, you know, there's no one making calls to the U.S. to plot a NATO or to pull troops out of the Far East, or, you know, really curtail its side of the military or cut back on, you know, foreign military bases. It's really sort of, to me, it's just politics. You know, cutting foreign aid is just politics. People don't really like foreign aid. They think it's a huge percentage of the budget, and it's not. And it becomes an easy way for politicians to score political points. It's short-sighted. You're absolutely right, and it's sort of a very silly approach. But, you know, it's the nature of politics. And look, let's be honest about it. You know, the Republicans in Congress want to cut everything,
right.
Not just foreign aid.
No, it's education,
it's health care, it's environmental, you know, enforcement. So, you know, it's a panoply of items they would like to cut back on. So.
Well, it's sort of a sexy issue because there are plenty of right-wingers in the Republican Party who aren't pro-Israel or pro-Jews. A lot of money goes to them. There's a lot of people in the Republican Party and the right wing are anti-Muslim and anti-Arab. So, in a sense, if most of the foreign policy money goes to those two directions, and a lot of it to Israel is really military credits, let's face it, I can see it is a good political gambit. You know, also a significant amount of money, not in real terms of our budget, goes to the Abbas-led PA, Palestinian Authority, who many believe regard his and their rhetoric as supporting terrorism, anti-Americanism. There have been calls for this money to be shut off. What could be the pluses and minuses of this action? Would it give us more influence or less influence?
To cut off money to Palestinians.
Yeah.
Well, it would be a disaster for Israel, actually, ironically enough. You know, one of the things that important to remember is the Palestinian Authority, their funding comes to the United States. And if that funding was cut off, it would mean the Palestinian Authority no longer exists. And the Palestinian Authority is responsible for, I forget the number, something like 40% of all jobs, you know, in Palestine come from the Palestinian Authority. They basically, that is the backbone of the Palestinian economy. So I would imagine cutting off funding to the PA would lead to a third Intifada, lead to violence.
Right. Chaos.
It would be a complete disaster.
Right. You know, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel. My guest is Michael Cohen, author, commentator about foreign policy, American politics, and the contemporary issues around it. Our subject today has been the Middle East, life after the deposed dictators, the state of American politics as we enter into the last 2 months of the year, into our holiday season. And the next stage of the American political season with a caucus and primaries is starting earlier and earlier. 4 years ago, the Republican primary field had 10 candidates, which included people mostly forgotten out of politics like Brownback, Huckabee, Tancredo, Hunter, Thompson. You still have Ron Paul, Gilmore, and Rudy Giuliani. The two finalists were Romney and McCain. Today, even before a vote has been counted, another large field of GOP wannabes has been winnowed down to three contenders, it seems. Herman Cain, Governor Rick Perry, and Mitt Romney. Michael, can you handicap the remaining contenders in this field? And what are their strengths and liabilities going forward, even though it seems to change by the moment?
Well, if That's a tough question to answer, actually, Richard, because, you know, the things that make somebody a strong candidate in the Republican Party are not the same things that make them a strong candidate in the general election. So, you know, Herman Cain is currently leading the GOP national polls. I do not think there's any chance that he will be the Republican nominee for president. I mean, I think his liabilities are fairly obvious to anyone that ever listened to him speak, particularly about a foreign policy.
And he opened up, and in a head-to-head race today, he was showing 47 over 39 over Romney. Maybe they just don't like Romney.
I think that's actually, that's the more important issue here. I mean, what I find fascinating, if you look at Romney's numbers, they basically have stuck pretty much at between 20 and 25% for, I think, most of this year. So you had a brief moment of, you had Trump was the big thing in the fall. I mean, the spring, excuse me. Over the summer, you had Bachman, then it was Perry. You know, all of them sort of fell off. Now it's Cain. You know, it's sort of, each of them are trying out to be the anti-Romney. And so I think what's interesting is that for Romney, at least, who I think will probably be the nominee, he has two issues here. One is he doesn't have real support in the Republican Party. His support is extremely soft, and it's, And there's a whole, you know, I'd say quarter, third of the party that doesn't really want to vote for him and will, you know, doesn't view him as being conservative enough and doesn't really want to support him. That's a problem. I mean, what's also interesting about it is this. You know, Cain's getting about 30% of the vote. Romney's getting about 25%. People like Perry and Bachman and Gingrich are getting, you know, 7, 10, 12%. Where do you think that support is going to go to? It might go to Romney, but... You know, you would think that people who are supporting Michelle Bachman or Rick Perry are more likely to support Herman Cain than they are to support Romney. Mm-hmm. So I think it's sort of fascinating how that has happened. And, of course, you know, Perry, I suppose, could rally, but he has shown himself to be a rather poor campaigner, so I don't really see it happening.
And he shoots himself in the foot almost at every opportunity. But it's also interesting that we've gotten to a stage with especially the challenging party, when there's an incumbent president, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that the challenging party is the base seems to be out of step with the mainstream of the country. You know, again, most political pundits and talking heads regard Mitt Romney, despite his inconsistencies, his well-documented flip-flops, as the one candidate who can appeal to independent and non-affiliated voters. I mean, that's where they want to go. Will this appeal to mainstream independents hurt Romney, again, with 70% of the GOP that seem to be wary of his conservative purity? And that's the question. Is someone else have an opportunity to step in?
I can't see at this point. You know, I mean, I just don't see who that person would be. It's too late in the process. And, you know, the people who are rivals of Romney are all such weak candidates. I mean, Perry, you know, not only is he sort of a poor campaigner and a poor politician, but he really hurt himself on immigration issues. You know, that is a touchstone issue for conservatives. And he was, you know, criticized conservatives for being opposed to in-state tuition for illegal immigrants. So, you know, that by being compassionate toward immigrants, that illegal immigrants, that actually really hurt his chances. I mean, I think Michelle Bachman has not done very well either, and Cain. I mean, you know, the thing with Cain is that I'm sort of amazed at how long he's actually maintained a viable presence in the race. I mean, he keeps making mistake after mistake after mistake and doesn't seem to have any effect at all. It's bizarre, but it can't continue. I guess it could continue. I shouldn't say that, but right. It's so hard to imagine a situation where he could somehow be the Republican nominee for president.
Well, we haven't seen the polls that will come out after this latest situation dealing with the theory or the practicalness of sexual harassment. And of course, from my perspective and most of the talking heads, if he would have dealt with it and said, look, in corporate life, we get accused of these things all the time. It was easier to take care of it than litigate it and go on from there. I'm pretty sure he could have buried it. He had plenty of time to think about it over the last 13 years. He certainly had plenty of time to think over the last 10 days to get his story straight. You know, this election cycle's GOP field seems to me more right-wing than ever. You were here a year ago discussing the effect of the Tea Party branch of the Republican Party regarding the politics of stalemate, which it's certainly been the last year. After a full year of stalemate, how do you judge the mainstream's voter attitude today and going forward? Have they started to turn on this idea that of stalemate is a better way to go?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think what's interesting is to see what will be interesting is to figure out what ends up happening with the sort of emerging populist political movement that we're seeing with Occupy Wall Street, and certainly this is something that Obama has picked up on his campaign. I think it'd be fascinating to see how it plays out over the next couple of months. In a weird way, Romney, you know, you said before he's the most logical nominee, and he's certainly the one who has seemed to have the most sort of, you know, broadest appeal. But yet he's also the one most associated with Wall Street. He's the one most associated with sort of, you know, capitalism. And so in a weird way, his experience as a as private in the private sector is actually a liability for him. It could be a liability for him.
If
Obama runs a sort of populist campaign, a sort of class warfare campaign, which by the way I think is totally appropriate. You know, we have class warfare in the country is being waged against the middle class and the poor. You know, I think that actually could be a real liability for Romney. In a weird way, Romney, because of his private sector background, because of his Wall Street background, he may actually be the worst positioned pick of any of the Republicans.
Yeah, that's true. It's very interesting. I think they've got themselves into a box, but maybe the last year or 2 years has created the box that they can't do much about it. You know, you're listening to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WVOX Radio, 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX.com. My guest, Michael A. Cohn, author, commentator about foreign policy and historical and contemporary political issues of interest to Americans. You know, we've been talking about the domestic politics, the emerging Republican finalists, the impact of the Tea Party faction on mainstream body politic. You know, in the recent spate of debates, few questions regarding foreign policy and President Obama's successes have been addressed. Michael, will the president's actions be addressed in the coming debates, and will his accomplishments give him a distinct advantage next November over people who don't seem to be interested in foreign policy except getting away from it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's an interesting question, and I'm actually writing something on this right now, and I'm trying to sort of figure this out. I mean, foreign policy matters more often than people recognize, although less so since the end of the Cold War. But, you know, you think about this, what's different about Obama is that he actually has a good story to tell. He actually has an advantage on national security. You know, he killed bin Laden, toppled Gaddafi, got out of Iraq, began to draw down from Afghanistan, even that policy has been something of a disaster. But still, I mean, there are lots of things you can point to as successes. We've never seen that. We've been in 70 years of a Democrat who actually has a good story to tell on foreign policy, or even more so, a Democrat who actually has an advantage on it. So it's sort of, we're in uncharted territory here. I don't think we have any clear sense of how this is going to play out next year. I mean, if the Obama people are smart, and I assume they are because they did get elected in the first place, this has got to be a focus. I mean, this can't be the focus. Obviously, the economy and unemployment will be the number one focus and number one, two, and three focus. But they have a good story to tell. And, you know, not just that he's had success in foreign policy, but that success and tends to bolster his overall presidential image, right? It makes him look like a decisive leader. It makes him look strong. All the things that he doesn't look so great on the economy, he looks better on foreign policy.
You know,
in a way, the more that you can make him look like a strong leader, the way that you can convince people that he knows what he's doing, he's confident, it actually helps deflect some of the criticism he's going to take from Republicans. So I think it has the potential to play a role. It will not play a decisive role. It will not be a dominant role. But I think, you know, it's certainly something that could benefit them. And the thing is also, Republicans are going to attack him from the right. That's at least what I've seen from Romney so far. I don't think that's a winning policy for them. I don't think people want to go back to what happened in the Bush administration. And so I think the more that Obama can create a contrast between what his policies on foreign policy and what Republicans are recommending, the better off he's going to be, I think. And it could actually play to his advantage. Again, within reason, you know, along the margins, but it could certainly be helpful.
You know, it's interesting to me. I don't see Herman Cain as the potential nominee of the party for many, many reasons. And the only alternative, the alternative for Romney is Perry. And the question is, you know, Perry keeps on shooting himself in the foot. But if this great opposition to Romney, whether it's irrational over being a Mormon or it's irrational over Wall Street or what, which may be rational over Wall Street, or if it's, you know, some kind of suicidal thoughts, I mean, Perry theoretically could be the, you know, the next George W. Bush to them. And to me, the foreign policy issue would become even more acute. But to this casual observer, that the, you know, two mainstream GOP senators, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, with a great deal of influence regarding foreign policy, were reluctant to afford the president any credit regarding the fall of Gaddafi, even though by all accounts we were right there at the start, supplying all the command and control, all the logistics with little expense and no casualties. Is this sour grapes, a lack of bipartisanship starting to have a reverse effect with regards to the president's approval rating? Is this something that the Republicans just can't have any iota of generosity?
That's a great question. I mean, I think, first of all, I would quibble with your notion that they're mainstream Republicans on foreign policy. I think they're actually quite conservative on foreign policy. But then again, I guess being conservative in the GOP is now the mainstream. But, you know, the thing is, I was really struck by the response to, for example, in Iraq. You know, Obama abiding by the agreement signed by George W. Bush to pull troops out of Iraq, you know, the fact that the Iraqi government said, we don't want you to stay, you know, that was just completely ignored in public and criticism. I mean, for Graham to go on TV and McCain to basically attack Obama, that was sort of ludicrous. But even more ludicrous was that they attacked him on Libya, too, and it was this insane notion that he could have toppled Gaddafi sooner. I mean, Gaddafi was power for 41 years. It took 5-6 months to knock him out of power. And yet, for some of the GOP, that wasn't fast enough. And I saw, you know, Rubio on television giving credit to the British and the French and ignoring the role of the U.S. I mean, can you imagine if a Democrat did that? I think, to me, these criticisms are just silly. I mean, there are very legitimate criticisms of Obama's foreign policy. I've made many of them. I think you can criticize him for his policies in Afghanistan. I think you can criticize him for, you know, even to some extent on how he handled Libya intervention. But these criticisms are just ludicrous. And I think, in a way, they make Republicans kind of look silly. I mean, I've heard this from Republicans as well, that it just makes them look bad. Mm-hmm. It makes them look like that, you know, if Obama had, had sort of somehow resolved the Arab-Israeli conflict tomorrow, they would say, you know, why didn't you do it sooner? Or if it was world peace tomorrow, why didn't you do it sooner? I mean, it just makes them look kind of silly after a while. And so I sort of wonder, I mean, this is clearly appears to be the road that they're taking. This is how Romney talked about this in his speech last month to the Citadel, you know, sort of a criticizing a lot of apologists and so on. But to me, it's just sort of, it will not ring true. Because it's not true, first of all. But I think it just doesn't square with Obama's accomplishment, you know, from whether it's Bin Laden to Libya to Iraq.
You know, it's interesting, and you bring that up about ludicrous statements. John McCain, who's had his share of them over the last number of decades, made a comment not too long ago that seemed to blow away very quickly for his sake about Obama's bus that was made in Canada, how terrible it was, even though it was fitted out for a president in Tennessee. And the irony is that McCain used the same bus. And five other presidents have used the same bus out of Canada and that was refitted in Tennessee. Like, a lot of our products come from all over and are assembled here. What was on his mind that day?
Oh, I mean, it's just politics. I mean, come on. You know, I mean, that's a funny story. I've not heard that story, actually.
Oh,
but, I mean, it's sort of classic. You know, it's classic sort of political tech. And, you know, I mean, both sides obviously engage that kind of stuff. But, boy, I'll tell you, the level of you know, attacks on Obama has just been... And this is the thing. This is where I wonder. I don't have a good answer for this, and I just don't know. Is when you see attacks like that are so ludicrous. I mean, for a certain segment of the population, they will believe anything about Obama. Mm-hmm. You know, if you tell them he wasn't born in America, they'll believe that. Tell them he's a socialist, they'll believe that. So clearly, there's people who will believe anything about Obama. But I just think for a lot of Americans who look at this stuff, after a while, I wonder to what extent they just kind of say, these guys are nuts. Yeah. they're just making stuff up. I mean, I don't want to say all Republicans. That's not really fair. But there's the level of sort of the bar has been lowered on what people, you know, can accuse the president of, and it's I don't know. To me, it seems like it's an unhelpful thing. It's helpful among your party's base, and clearly, this stuff plays well among Republicans. There's no question about it. I don't know if it plays well in general election. It's one reason why you've seen Romney not be as out there on some of the stuff as someone like Perry has been or Michelle Bachmann and other folks.
You know, Michael, in our last few moments, one thing that the president has done that I'd like to hear you a quick comment on is his use of executive privilege. Of course, He had only used it, I believe, 99 times. It has been declining in the years. Reagan used it 300 or 400 times. Franklin Roosevelt used it 13,000. But it's interesting that has he made some inroads with this direct action of executive privilege?
Well, if you ask liberals, they'll say he hasn't used it enough. They'll say, oh, it's funny. Here's the weird thing about it. On foreign policy, he's been quite inclined to sort of to defend the idea of the of executive power. You know, on Libya, I mean, I thought this was actually really beyond the pale what he did in Libya. He basically said Congress had no right to weigh in on the decision to intervene in Libya, and the War Powers Act wasn't applicable, which I think was also ludicrous. You know, and certainly on detainee issues, he's been much more aggressive in pushing executive power. Or he hasn't done as much as on domestic issues, which is, of course, you know, upset the left to no end. What you're seeing now, of course, in recent weeks, is a shift in that. You've seen much more of an effort. This whole "why can't we can't wait" campaign he's been executing on, trying to do things via the executive branch. I mean, his options are limited, and you know, I think it's probably in some ways probably a good thing for him politically to do. But I do worry myself about putting too much power in the executive branch, and you've seen this for, you know, the Bush administration, how much power the Bush administration took for the executive branch, you know, whether it was wiretapping, it was torture, all kinds of issues that didn't get approval of Congress. And it's a little worrisome that Obama's taken a similar course on foreign policy. I mean, that would be a good criticism of Obama and Republicans to make, that he's creating this sort of out-of-control executive branch on foreign policy, but, you know.
Well, they made every kind of, as you mentioned before, they made every kind of criticism. You know, the original Citizen Kane, which the new Citizen Kane should pay a little attention to. You know, there was a part in it where the one part of the audience said, he's a fascist. And one part of the audience said, he's a communist. And it seems that Obama and the original Citizen Kane says, well, I'm just an American. It seems Obama is as American as apple pie.
to you and I maybe, but to a lot of Americans, right. He's not. And that's, you know, I don't think it's hard to figure out why that would be the case.
Well, of course, you're right. Barry Obama comes a little bit closer to the American ideal than Barack Hussein Obama.
Hussein Obama, right. Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
We have only about 2 minutes left, but in that half of that time, I just want to revisit this once again. You do not see an opportunity for any other Republican to get into this race if the three finalists absolutely soil themselves to such a degree that they can't win. They either can't win the nomination or they can't win a general election. You believe that?
I don't see any possible way. I mean, I don't see it. I mean, if, you know, Pawlenty wants to reactivate his campaign, maybe, but he has to raise so much money and build a campaign structure, I don't see it happening. It's a little late in the game for that.
And moderates like Huntsman and other people who could attract some disaffected Democrats, the Reagan Democrats, the middle of the roaders, etc., they're just out of the loop.
I mean, you know, Huntsman's got what, 2% support in the party?
Right. He can't. Yeah. You know, meanwhile, thank you, Michael. I want, I always enjoy you being here for joining me today. Anything new on the horizon in the last 10 seconds that you're working on?
Well, I'm writing a little more for foreignpolicy.com these days, so hopefully you can see some of my pieces there. But I'll just keep plugging away the way I have the past couple of years.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'll have you back sometime during the year when we get more towards the convention. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. My pleasure as always.
All right. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information on my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll be hosting Professor James Longo of Washington and Jefferson University. We'll be discussing presidents, first ladies, as teachers and students. Again, I'm signing off. This is Richard Garfunkel, The Advocates. Speak to you next week, and have a great day. Thanks a lot.